Good morning and welcome to Spotlight 92. I'm your host, Malvin Massey. And of course, every Thursday we talk to the movers and shakers of our community, the people that are making things happen for your benefit and mine. And our community means the community of the world. And our guest today is a reporter for PBS Frontline and a contributor to The Economist. He has formerly served as the Washington Post bureau chief in East Asia, Eastern Europe, and Africa. He's also worked as a national correspondent for the New York Times and as a writer for the Times magazine. He's the author of Africa, Dispatches from a Fragile Continent, and A River Lost, The Life and Death of Columbia. He lives in Seattle, Washington, but he's calling us right now. And we are on the front. His new book, his book that we are talking about today is Escape from Camp 14, One Man's Remarkable Odyssey from North Korea to Freedom in the West. And our guest this morning is Mr. Blaine Harden. Good morning, Mr. Harden.
Good morning. Nice to talk to you.
Thank you so much for giving us a call. You know, like I was saying before, I am totally fascinated by this book. It's very hard to put it down when you start reading it. And some of the things in it are so, my God, they're the stuff of Hollywood exaggeration. But these stories are true. How did you discover Shin's story, and what inspired you to track him down?
Well, I was in Northeast Asia for the Washington Post, and my job was to try to write about North Korea, try to explain what life is like in the country, and try to explain why its totalitarian system has lasted so long, far longer than any other totalitarian state in history. So what I did is I searched for defectors, people who'd come out of North Korea, found their way through China to South Korea. And I met Shin in December of 2008. He had been there for about a year and a half, and he was one of many defectors in the country. But he is the only one, the only known individual to have been born in one of their political labor camps and to escape to the West.
It's amazing that he got away with all the things that he went through. His name is Shin Dong-hyuk.
That's right.
That's right. Yeah. I had an uncle who was involved in the Korean War, and a cousin who's a veteran of patrolling the DMZ. Korea and North Korea have been a sticking point for the West for a long time. A lot of times people will say that some of the stories coming out of Korea since it's been so sheltered for so long are hard to believe. You can't believe everything that comes out of it. And you, how are you going to believe the people? What was the difficulty in trying to research the political prison camps in North Korea, and where'd you get how'd you verify the stories?
That's a really good question and an important question. One cannot go to North Korea and see the camps. North Korea denies that the camps exist. They never have allowed outsiders to go to them. However, they are visible, very visible, on high-resolution satellite images that any of your listeners could find on their home computers or on their smartphones. At Google Earth, you can go and look up the North Korean gulag and see Camp 14, the camp where Shin was born and he escaped from. In fact, he has annotated the buildings and the fence in the camp where things happened to him and where he escaped. Mm-hmm. So the way of verifying the story, it's difficult. It's not the same as going and looking. But since that's impossible, this is what I did. First of all, Shin's body is a roadmap to the story that he tells. Mm-hmm. He says that when he was 13, he was taken to an underground prison inside the camp and tortured for his suspected role in an escape plan of his mother and brother. And he said that he was held over a hot coal fire. His lower back and buttocks are severely burned, and the scars are quite horrific on his back. He says that when he escaped, when he was 23, he was burned and by high-voltage wires on his legs, and his legs are severely scarred. He said that when he was working in a sewing machine factory in a garment factory in the camp, he dropped a sewing machine and was punished by having a guard use a knife to hack off part of his finger on his right hand that is missing. And he also has scars. He's also stunted from malnutrition, and his arms are bowed from childhood labor. Mm-hmm. I think the third thing is that I have talked to several other survivors of the camps who know Shin, who know the camps, and who say that his story is that of someone who was in the camps. And yet he knows more than anybody else because he was raised in the camp. And then finally I've talked to all of the scholars who've interviewed everyone who's come out of the camps, including Shin, and they find his story to be credible and consistent. And what they say is that if his story is false, let us in there and let us go see. And if it's false, we'll say so.
But they never they deny the camps exist, so there's no reason to even deny that that these stories that are coming out of there have any truth to them.
Right.
Yeah, and oh gosh, some of the things that he said, the idea of the brainwashing, which is I guess a modern term for brainwashing, but for him being brought up in the camp to follow those rules,
the rules of the camp are just incredibly draconian, and they had a very big effect on his life and on the life and death of his mother and brother. The first rule of the camp is if you attempt to escape, you will be shot immediately. And a corollary to that rule is if you know of somebody who talks about escape and fail to report it, you will be shot immediately. Shin was taught these rules. He memorized them like good Baptist children memorize the Ten Commandments. And he heard when he was 13 his mother and brother discussing an escape. He immediately reported them, and they were executed in front of him as a result of his snitching.
And in front of himself and his father, after his
torture.
In front
of him and his father, he was forced to watch.
Even after he told them, even after he snitched, he was still tortured. That incident you were talking about, the 13,
right.
When he was 13.
Yeah, he turned in his mother and brother, and then he was himself suspected of involvement in that plot. And to try to get a confession out of him, he was tortured when he was 13. He had nothing to confess other than that he turned them in, and so they ultimately decided not to kill him. So he survived on, although he was, as I said, he was very much scarred by that.
One thing that really fascinated me about it was the idea that when he did it, when he turned his parents, his mother and his brother in, he was following the rules of the camp, and he really had no idea of, and that bothers him. He had no idea of remorse for what he did.
No, and he has remorse now. It's, you know, well after the fact. But and it's a painful, awful regret and guilt that he carries. But he's learned that reaction from understanding, once he got outside the camp when he was 23, how normal people live, what normal family relationships are like. He spent a couple years after he got out living in Southern California, and in the embrace of a very loving Christian Korean-American family. And they invited him for supper every Saturday night. He spent that time over there, and then he got to know the kids. And the kids' relationship with the parents' relationship with each other, all of it for him was like studying a foreign language. It was confusing, it was interesting, and it was very hard to imitate. And he still struggles with the idea of love and family, of loyalty, of trust. And that is the legacy of the camp. And the reason he told me in the reporting on this book, he had not disclosed when he first came to South Korea that he was the snitch who was responsible for his mother and brother's death. He didn't disclose that because he thought, and probably rightly so, that the South Korean government might think that he was some sort of agent or something. He didn't disclose it until he was with me. He'd been doing interviews with me for more than a year, and we were in Southern California. But he said, you know, I'm surrounded by people now who trust me and love me, and I feel like I need to tell the truth. And that's why he did. But it has been a very slow process for him to come to grips with normal human relationships. What he said, and I think this is the very powerful statement, he said, I am learning how to be human, but it is going very slowly. I hear people laugh and cry, and sometimes I try to do that myself, but tears don't come and laughter doesn't come.
He has no problem. prior experience to it, as we all grew up with a childhood and the foibles and the facts and the good things and the bad things that come along with growing up in a society.
Right. He cannot remember ever hearing the word love in the camp. He does not remember any time of sitting on his mom's lap or being held by his father. He has no memory of that at all.
Hmm. Yeah. If you just tuned in, by the way, this is Spotlight 92. We are talking to Mr. Blaine Hardin, author of Escape from Camp 14, One Man's Remarkable Odyssey from North Korea to Freedom in the West. And it's the story of Shin Dong-yuk, who is the only person so far known to have been born in the non-existent North Korean labor camps, and to have escaped and lived to tell his story. It's a fascinating story. You know, when you first met him, it's a matter of him trusting everybody else. When did you start trusting him?
Well,
initially
I trusted him. He had told his story to other reporters. He had written a short book about his experience, which no one had paid any attention to in South Korea. South Korea, strangely enough, is not very interested in the North Korean camps or in the human rights situation in North Korea. They're very much more interested in their economy and their growth, and they're just in a different place. It's the 11th largest economy in the world. In any case, Shin had come into South Korea and was a dislocated and depressed individual. And I met him, and he told me his story. What struck me when I first met him is he told me the story about his mother being executed in front of him. And he said that when she was hanged in front of him, he refused to catch her eye, even though she tried to look at him. And he said, I hated her, and I still hate her. He blamed her for his torture in the camp, and he thought that she was reckless and irresponsible for having thought about escape. So he was a creature of the guards who'd brought him into existence. His parents were chosen by the guards, and he was bred like a farm animal in the camp. And it was the guards' values that were his values, and the guards' rules that were his commandments for behavior.
Gosh, that's another part. That story is so hard to understand. From Angola to Turkey and the Albanians, we know of man's inhumanity to man, quite flagrant. It's all over the Nazi story and the Jews and the Holocaust and all those things are horrible. But this attitude of the guards, which you just mentioned, and which is explained very well in the book, by the way, the attitude of the guards, it's hard for me to even understand that they could treat an enemy like that, like they treat the people in that camp. How in the world is it possible that they can justify the treatment of those people who belong to their own people?
Well, the guards are carefully chosen, very carefully chosen. And it's a really good question. Why would anybody be a guard, and what would be in it for them? The guards are usually, almost exclusively, they're the children of intelligence people in the government. And they come from relatively privileged backgrounds, isolated from the general population of North Korea, a third of whom are chronically malnourished. So these are children who grow up with loyalty to the state, because the state does provide food and clothing and a measure of security to their parents. So they're carefully chosen from the right stock, and then they're indoctrinated. I spent a long time talking to a guard who worked in four camps before he defected. He told me that they were taught by the government to regard the prisoners as pigs and as dogs and not as human beings. Because they, because the prisoners had allegedly been disloyal to the Kim family dynasty that runs the country, they were to be regarded as subhuman. This guard that I talked to, he told me that he had beaten crippled people. He had seen other guards murder women that they had impregnated, because women are not allowed to have sex, and if they become pregnant in the camps, in an unauthorized way, such as having sex with a guard, they're murdered. He said these things go on casually, and some of the violence from guards towards the prisoners is simply a result of guards being bored.
That's so terrifying to even think about. And the idea that when they do these things, they think they're doing right, and they have no, even and even in the book, something that came out as about the guards was that they are not as malnourished as the prisoners, but even those people who are considered privileged in North Korea are malnourished.
Well, privilege is a relative term. This country is poorer than Sudan, and it's surrounded, as you know, by some of the richest, fastest growing economies on earth: the South Korea, China, Japan. It is an island of despair and poverty and hunger, surrounded by, you know, really an impressive capitalist/communist model in China, and so it is the great exception. And to sustain totalitarian rule, you cannot have a vibrant economy, you cannot have economic freedom, you cannot have much freedom at all. The camps are a classic tool of totalitarian systems. What they do is they terrify most of the population. They terrify the 23 million people of North Korea, and then they get rid of the 200,000 or so that the state regards as political enemies. There are six of the camps in North Korea now, according to the South Korean government. They're clearly visible on satellite images. You can see them on Google Earth. And the U.S. government believes there are around 200,000 people in the camp right now. Amnesty International said last year that based on its analysis of the satellite images of the camps, they seem to be growing with new construction. And Amnesty International has hypothesized the growth in the population of the camp is because of the transition in power. Another hereditary dictator comes up. Kim Jong-il died of a heart attack in December. Mm-hmm. His young, untested son comes along. He's about 29. And the loyalty of the population is not guaranteed. And to give it the guarantee that they need, they lock up those who might be doubters.
And Kim Jong-un is going, also political situations and strategic situations involved with that are that generally they flex their muscles to intimidate. When they do things like when he attacked the island in South Korean island.
Right.
When they do things like that, they don't. Those things are not geared to cause a reaction in the West. They really don't care about the reactions in the West. Those kind of things are pretty much geared to trying to maintain the Kim dynasty in Korea, in North Korea.
Right. The propaganda inside the state works rather well. They have convinced a large percentage of the population that North Korea is a kind of white virgin, constantly being imperiled by those who would rape the virtue of the country, and that the Kim family is the great protector of that virtue. So they periodically fire missiles into the ocean, or explode small nuclear devices, or shell a South Korean island, or sink a South Korean ship as a way of showing their strength in response to this propagandized threat, which many North Koreans, when they come out, they are really astonished to realize what the real world is about, and that no one really wants to invade North Korea.
Yeah, of course not. There's no profit in it, for one thing. If you just tuned in again, by the way, this is Spotlight 92. We are talking to author Blaine Hardin. His book is Escape from Camp 14. It's one man's remarkable odyssey from North Korea to freedom in the West. And it's the story of a gentleman by the name of Shin Dong-yuk, who escaped. And the book is on the open market now, right? I mean, Escape from Camp 14.
It came out a week ago.
Oh, great. Great, yeah. It's something that everybody should pay attention to. But I wonder, is it the idea or the fact that North Korea is so impoverished, and real people, the CIA, the Justice Department, people who are in the know about nuclear arms and what and all those things, don't really consider North Korea to be a threat to anybody else. Is that part of the reason that they are sort of left alone? There's not very much media about it. Nobody talks about North Korea very much.
Well, North Korea periodically flares up into the public imagination, into the news, and it does so usually by threats. With it has exploded two small nuclear devices in the past 7 years. It has fired long-range missiles. It has the technology, according to rocket experts in the United States, to perhaps reach the west coast of the United States with a long-range missile. If they can figure out how to put a nuclear warhead on a long-range missile and reach the west coast, they become a very, very important strategic threat to the United States. And it is that concern that drives U.S. policy in the past decade, as the technology has become apparent that they can make the bombs and perhaps deliver them. So that is what has preoccupied U.S. foreign policy towards North Korea. However, the North Korean human rights situation has been just ignored throughout the focus, because of the focus on nuclear issues. The reason Shin wanted to participate in doing this book, and the participation for him was not pleasant because he hates to talk about what happened to him, he wants to raise Americans' awareness so they understand whenever they think about North Korea, they think about these camps and what is happening to children, particularly children inside them, but also to the parents and the other adults. And so that human rights can become part of an understanding of North Korea, and it will become part of the policy of the United States whenever it negotiates with North Korea or with China about anything, to have human rights as part of the agenda.
Yeah, it was really heartbreaking to read the passages in the passage in there when he was in school and the guard beat a little girl to death for having five pieces of corn in her pocket. And everybody in the class was relatively indifferent to it. It was just something that happened.
They knew the rules of the camp, and the camp's rules said, all the children had been memorizing them from when they were toddlers. If you find food and don't give it to the camp guards, they can kill you. Yeah. And Shin witnessed this. He remembers it very vividly, but he equally vividly remembers that he thought that the little girl probably deserved it because she had violated the rules. Of course, he thinks differently now, but at that point, he was a captive of their mentality.
Yeah. What do you hope that this book does? I mean, as far as, like we said, do you think, well, one thing before I go to that one, though, do you think the Kim family would actually be foolish enough to actually attack China, America, South Korea? Do you think they really would do that?
No, I don't think that they would attack South Korea or Japan or the United States. However, there is a perceived risk that if they are attacked, if they feel militarily imperiled, that they would attack South Korea. And they're in a very good position to cause incredible havoc in Seoul. Seoul's a city of more than 20 million people. It's about 35 miles from the North Korean border. North Korea has about 80% of its army and all of its artillery right along the border. And within 10 minutes, and this is a CIA estimate, within 10 minutes, they could fire their artillery and wound or kill tens to hundreds of thousands of people in Seoul. So they have this real, very real extortion, a military extortion, on one of our most important allies in Asia. And for that reason, what North Korea represents is a very real threat. And dealing with it is tricky. Mm-hmm. It's just a very difficult situation.
What do you hope the book can accomplish in awareness of not only human rights, but just understanding the mentality of North Koreans.
What we want to do with this book is to tell a story. People understand the world through stories of people, of individuals. And Shin's story is, if you read it, it's horrifying, but it's also redemptive. He got out of there. He's the only one to get out of one of these camps who was born in it. And so through his life, you can understand how the camps work, how North Korea runs the country, how it maintains control, and you can have an emotional as well as an intellectual understanding of what North Korea is. And our hope is that by doing this book, that Americans from now on will think of North Korea in a different way, a more accurate way, and demand that their government respond accordingly in its dealings with North Korea. You know, it's unlikely there will be a quick solution to the problem. Mm-hmm. But awareness is better than ignorance, and pressure is better than tolerance.
Yeah, I got a copy of the article you did April 4th in the L.A. Times about, of course, the parallels with the Hunger Games that's out right now, and the situation of the Kim Dynasty in North Korea. Do you think that our culture is ready to get that involved in human rights on the other side of the world?
Well, you know, it takes a while to wake up the American society. You know, it took a long time to wake up to what Hitler was up to in Germany. It took, you know, an attack on Pearl Harbor. It took the events of 9/11 to wake up to the threat of Al-Qaeda and what it was up to. It's a big world with a lot of problems and a lot of human misery, and people, you know, have to make a living, and times aren't good here in the United States. Mm-hmm. However, understanding is just better than ignorance, and this situation in North Korea has gone on for 5 decades. It deserves our attention and our understanding and our sympathy and our prayers, at the very least. And that's why Shin was willing to do this book, and that's why I've spent the past 3 years working on it.
You know, as bureau chief for the Washington Post in East Asia, Eastern Europe, and Africa, you have experienced a lot of different cultures and governments. Is there any possibility that East Asian populations, East Asian peoples, will be concerned about what's happening in North Korea?
They're very knowledgeable. They're very knowledgeable about North Korea, much more so than Americans, because it's their neighborhood. And in Japan is actually easily targeted by thousands of missiles that exist in North Korea. So, and there would be very little that Japan could do to protect itself if North Korea chose to hit it with a bunch of medium range missiles. So there's real awareness there based on self-interest of what's going on in North Korea. The question is that understanding tends to become attenuated and simplified the farther you get away from the place. Most Americans probably couldn't find North Korea on a map, and they could not tell you how the country has survived for so long as a totalitarian system. Understanding the camps is a key to understanding why this place is still there and still run by a gang of criminals.
Mm. Well, once again, the book is Escape from Camp 14, One Man's Remarkable Odyssey from North Korea to Freedom in the West by Blaine Harden. And the illustrations on the inside of his of some of his things that he saw in that camp really got me. This whole book is very difficult to put this book down once you start reading it, and I suggest that if you have any interest in human rights whatsoever, you might want to get a copy. And it's out right now. And where can people pick it up?
Well, they can buy it online from Amazon, from Barnes & Noble, from Apple iTunes, and a lot of bookstores should have it. It's actually begun to sell, which is wonderful.
I tell you what, all you have to do is just start reading the first page, the first couple of pages of it, and you're going to read the whole book. So, yeah, it's going to sell a lot. Thank you, Blaine Harden. I appreciate your time, and thank you so much for being our guest on Spotlight 92.
Thank you very much.
And this has been Spotlight 92. We'll do it again next week. In the meantime, you're back for more of the best in jazz. This is U92 FM.